Every year, thousands go to the hospital to report sexual abuse, but many medical professionals don't have the proper training to help. Survivor Kate O'Brien was examined by an inexperienced nurse after an assault.
It was either the first or second one she had ever done, which was surprising. It makes you feel very unimportant, like what had happened to me wasn't a big deal, so it doesn't require someone who really knows what they're doing.
We're also looking at schools and universities across the country employing so-called poverty simulations in an effort to build empathy for those in poverty. University of Illinois professor Brenda Lindsay says simulations must be followed up with conversations.
But at the end of the day, what you want people to really think about is that, you know, this could happen maybe to almost anybody.
And a new robot being developed could change the way farmers collect data out in the fields. That's all coming up on the 21st after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. If ever there's a statistic that tells a story, it's this one. There are nearly 200,000 registered nurses in Illinois. 32 of them, just 32, have national certification to treat sexual assault patients to collect so-called rape kits. That's according to the reporting of the Chicago Tribune, which found serious consequences from the shortfall, including for vulnerable patients. Kate O'Brien shared with the Tribune her story of being in an emergency room and having an inexperienced nurse handle her rape kit.
It was either the first or second one she had ever done, which was surprising. It makes you feel very unimportant, like what had happened to me wasn't a big deal, so it doesn't require someone who really knows what they're doing.
That audio from the Chicago Tribune. There's an effort now in Springfield to create new law that would increase the number of nurses specially trained to handle sexual assault cases. For more on this, we're joined by Chicago Tribune reporter Allison Bowen. Hello, Allison.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And by Tegan Stanowski, Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Coordinator for the Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right. So, Allison, if we can just begin with you. We just heard some of the audio from Kate O'Brien from the interview she did with you guys. And as we said, she went to a Chicago emergency room back in 2009, actually. She said she had been sexually assaulted and found a nurse there who she said had never before used a rape kit, or at least it was either the first or second time that she had used a rape kit. So what was her experience like at the hospital?
Yeah, that's right. So she went to the emergency room, and the nurse who was treating her was very kind, but said something to the effect of, you know, this is the first time I'm doing this, so we're going to go really slow. And Kate kind of recounted to me how that was to hear. It didn't give her a lot of confidence, and it made her feel like what had happened to her, you know, wasn't important enough to have someone trained to do what she was doing. And the nurse also wasn't able to answer some of her questions, like, how can I tell if I've been drugged? And she didn't know what to do with evidence. So these are problems that can happen when nurses aren't trained to collect evidence and do rape kits.
It seems kind of amazing because every one of those elements you just described seem absolutely essential to a successful case brought against a perpetrator.
Right, yeah. And one thing that prosecutors told me is that when trained nurses do collect evidence, it is usually stronger evidence. Nurses who are trained are also trained to testify, so they can testify in these cases. That's also very important. And many nurses told me that they did want to undergo the training, but not every nurse has time off or the ability to undergo the training.
And so based on your experience, how common is what Kate found with her treatment at the hospital? How common is that?
It's not uncommon. In fact, many of the advocates I talked to for this found it unremarkable. And I found that jarring as well. Many people go to emergency rooms and encounter nurses who don't have training and perhaps are visibly uncomfortable collecting evidence. And many nurses also told me similar experiences they had. And in many cases, they sought training after an experience like that.
So they had an experience, realized their ability to help these patients was inadequate, and then took action.
Right. Yeah. Several told me that they had a sexual assault patient in the emergency room. One nurse, Melissa Cochran, told me about her first sexual assault patient. She was the only female nurse in the ER, and she treated her, and she had never opened a rape kit. And she opened up this box, and you just see all of these envelopes for evidence and instructions, and she told me that she'll think about that patient for the rest of her career.
Tegan, when a sexual assault survivor comes to the hospital, what should happen?
I'll tell you what happens usually when they come to my hospital, because we're lucky to have a program and staff in place. So what will happen if they come to our hospital is the SAY nurse will be called, and then that nurse will sit with the survivor and help develop that plan of care. The most important thing that we try to keep in mind is making sure that that patient gets to make the decisions, that they're in control of what we do, so that they get to decide what they can do, what they want to do, what they're willing to do. We talk about the different options they have, including talking to police, connecting with our local rape advocacy service, talking about testing or treating for STDs, discussing pregnancy prevention options, doing a head-to-toe physical assessment, and then also evidence collection with that. And they can choose to do any or all of those steps. And then the evidence collection part is what goes in the kit that we were talking about. The kit would include a copy of the paperwork from the interview, from the assessment, and then along with all the evidence, which would be cotton swabs from the survivor's body, sometimes blood or urine samples, and then occasionally their clothing, depending on the details of the assault.
I understand from Allison's great reporting that it's not just about evidence collection, as you kind of were alluding here. It's about how you talk to these patients. It's very critical, right, Allison?
Yes, absolutely. If someone's talking to a victim, someone who has just experienced a trauma, they're still reeling from that. They might be in shock. They might be acting strangely. The way that you phrase certain things can easily, even unwittingly, imply fault or disbelief. You know, think of saying something like, well, how much did you have to drink? And that can make a victim feel blamed. An advocate told me they call that the second rape. And it also can make them not want to go forward with the process.
Tegan, is this something you can add to the kind of delicate conversations that nurses have to have with the patients?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that I talk to my nurses a lot, and even to my ER staff, anybody who's going to have contact with this patient, that we want to make sure, even though I need to know the answers to questions like, did you have alcohol? Have you changed your clothes? Who were you with? Did you go there alone? That kind of thing. Those questions can seem really intense, especially when you have a patient, a survivor of sexual assault, who comes in, and a lot of times they've pretty well convinced themselves that this was their fault, that they shouldn't have gone to that party, they shouldn't have gone with that person, they shouldn't have gone out alone, they shouldn't have done, you know, A, B, C, whatever. And even though I know that this is not their fault, that they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, that somebody else decided to assault them, they didn't decide to get assaulted, it doesn't take much in terms of my body language and the way that I answer and ask questions to reinforce that. And so I try to really stay aware of that and make sure that I'm explaining to my patient that I'm going to ask you a lot of really specific, really vulnerable questions. They're going to feel really intense. And I want you to know that I'm not asking them to judge you. I'm asking them so that I can make sure that we're taking care of all of your medical needs and that we're getting all of the evidence that we can.
Now, Tegan, I understand you are what is called a licensed sexual assault nurse examiner, or SANE for short. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
And I understand that this is kind of alluding to the 32 number we gave at the beginning of the piece, which is kind of this kind of training on top of it, an imprimatur from an organization that says, you know, you're getting certified in this, that you are an expert in this type of care. And along with these 32, Allison, there's only a few others who just have the training without the certification, right?
Sure, yeah. So there's a national certification that's offered. But here in Illinois, the Attorney General's office also offers a variety of trainings throughout the state. And so about 150 nurses here in Illinois working in emergency rooms have completed the training from the Attorney General's office. And that includes about 40 hours of training, as well as following clinical work, like practicing genital exams, things like that.
Tegan, why are there so few of you out there with this kind of training? I mean, is it a money thing? Is it a lack of funds? What's the issue?
It's probably multiple things. Part of it is that it's kind of a squeamish area of medicine. A lot of people get uncomfortable talking about it. They worry about whether they'll be able to handle hearing over and over stories about how people were assaulted and how they will manage that. And then it's also, I think, an issue of not knowing that this field of nursing exists. A lot of nursing students come out of nursing school, and if they get to our ER, a lot of them didn't realize that forensic nursing was an option for them, that was a thing that they could learn about. And so just letting everybody know that this is, while a very specialized field, a really, really interesting one, and I think a really motivating and impactful field to be a part of.
Allison?
Yeah, I also want to point out that different hospitals provide different support for nurses in this field. So some hospitals that I reached out to provide paid time off to go to the training. Some hospitals might provide funding for exams. In other hospitals, those nurses might use their own vacation time for training and their own money for exams. So it really varies across the state, and I think that can have an impact on whether nurses feel like they are able to pursue this even if they want to.
I see. And Tegan, does it always need to be a nurse? Are there other medical professionals also involved in this kind of service?
There can be. There's not currently any specific designations for providers, either nationally or at the state level, but in our state, at least, we welcome all providers, doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, whoever, to come to the state-run SANE trainings, and we're hoping to develop designations for them with some upcoming legislation.
Yeah, and the upcoming legislation you were mentioning, Attorney General Lisa Madigan is working with lawmakers on that legislation to have trained medical provider present at every hospital for patients when they come in. Allison, can you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Sure, yeah. So what this proposed legislation would do is it would require hospitals to have someone specially trained in sexual assault present at the hospital within 90 minutes of a patient's arrival. So that could be a SANE nurse. It could also be a different medical provider. But that way, a patient, when they arrive within 90 minutes, someone that does have this training would be available to treat them.
And what is the medical community saying about this bill?
The Illinois Health and Hospital Association, in a statement, said that they think training this many nurses in that time frame is not feasible. But the Attorney General's office is very committed to providing training and extra trainings if necessary, is what they told me.
And do we have a sense of what kind of undertaking this would be? How many more nurses would have to be trained and why they don't believe? I understand the proposal is this would be a 5-year period where they would have to ramp up. So it seems like a lot of time.
Yeah, they would need to implement it by 2023. It is a large commitment to time to get these nurses trained on the way that the Attorney General's office provides these trainings. It's, you know, 40 hours. It's a week-long training plus the clinical work. But the Attorney General's office has hired an emergency room nurse to train her peers. Her entire job is to do these trainings. So they are available, and they have said they are hoping to do more. So it would be a matter of sending the nurses to the training and carving out that time.
Tegan, what kind of commitment and to resources and time was your training?
So it is the 40-hour classroom time, and that usually takes a few days because they do some of it online beforehand. But that 40 hours of clinical time, it can sound like a small number, especially for people who've been through clinical time for medical school or nursing school. You can do up to 90 or 100 hours in a semester, but this 40 hours, it's done by a nurse who's also probably working full-time. And those 40 hours are spread over a lot of different disciplines. So they spend time observing court proceedings. They spend time with law enforcement, with detectives. They spend time with the crime lab and with forensic photography professionals, as well as doing normal genital anatomy exams and then observing as many sexual assault exams as they can. So that can take a full year to complete. So when we talk about 40 hours, it's easy to sound like, oh, we can do that in a couple of months. But it takes usually a whole year to get a nurse through all of that to get their state certificate.
And one of the things I was struck by in your reporting, Allison, was you quoted a nurse who said, you know, you have to have continuing education. For example, looking for bruising in a person's mouth could show strangulation. She would have never thought of that. So this is very, very specialized, isn't it?
It is very specialized. And that nurse that you're speaking of has had years of training as a SANE nurse, years of treating patients, and she still does go through continuing education. So I asked her for an example of something she'd recently learned, and it was how to tell what kind of bruising in a mouth can indicate strangulation. So without that, she never would have known to check, and without that, she never would have recorded that for a patient that could potentially be something to go into evidence.
And so the current reality is we have this lack of nurses. And you had alluded to the effects of that in prosecutions earlier. Can you talk more about what it means for successful prosecutions and also what it means for how willing survivors are to then go forward with prosecutions?
Sure, sure. So survivors did tell me that the experience of being in an emergency room for them did make them think about whether they wanted to go forward or not. If they feel doubted, if they feel faulted, they may be less likely to want to go through with a rape kit. A rape kit can take hours in an emergency room, and often it's the last thing people feel like doing. So having a nurse who can really explain what it all means and what it could mean in future and their options as well is really key to that. So the nurses are also collecting strong evidence, which can bolster prosecutions, and it can also lead to more defendants pleading guilty, which can save a survivor from having to testify at trial potentially.
And this is not theoretical. The state of Illinois did a kind of sampling study and found an actual increase in convictions, didn't it?
Yeah, so in 1999, the legislation allotted funding to do some of these pilot programs, and then 4 years later, a report kind of evaluating them did point to better outcomes for victims, and there has been research across the country that shows that when you have trained nurses, it is better for prosecutions and for victims.
Hmm. Tegan, where does gender come into this conversation? We shouldn't assume that obviously all nurses are women, and we shouldn't assume that all sexual victims, assault survivors are women. There are women who prefer to see female gynecologists, for example, as more and more clinicians are being trained to provide these services. How do you consider gender when it comes to counseling and services?
So this is a really interesting question for me specifically, because we just sent our first male nurse to SANE training last month, and I'm super excited to see how he's going to fit into our program and how our patients are going to react to him. I know that we always try to make sure that we're being supportive of our patients' requests, since we want them to be in control and in the driver's seat of what we're doing that day, but I also think it can be incredibly healing to see a male nurse in that supportive role as opposed to in a more toxic role.
And Allison, how far along are we in this bill to increase the number of nurses who are specialized in treating sexual assault survivors?
So right now, the Attorney General's office is working with legislators to require this. I know that they're really hopeful about this. I know that this is an issue they're really committed to, but that's where it is right now.
So non-committal at the moment. Committal, but non-committal.
Possibly, yeah.
All right. Allison Bowen of the Chicago Tribune, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks so much.
And Tegan Stanowski with the Carle Foundation Hospital, thank you as well.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting A Return to the Madhouse, Climate Change Denial in the Age of Trump, April 6th at 3 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. Professor Michael Mann will examine the evidence of climate change and the reasons we should care. cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. Schools and universities across the country are using what are called poverty simulations. The idea is to role play what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck in order to build empathy for those living in poverty. The simulations have been around for a while, but they've grown in popularity amid questions over whether they're truly effective or potentially counterproductive. Lee Gaines joins us. She's been reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom, where she's an education reporter. Hi, Lee.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Brenda Cobley-Lindsay, Assistant Dean for Undergraduate Programs at the University of Illinois School of Social Work. Hello, Professor.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Lee, let's start with you. You reported on this back in February by going to a three-hour poverty simulation in Mahomet, just 15 minutes from Champaign. I understand this was a professional development training at a local middle school. Set the scene for us. Who was participating, and what did the people participating in this simulation actually do?
So it was at a middle school in a gym at the school, and it was about 100 teachers and also support staff members. So you had some bus drivers and people like that there as well. And so they were role-playing families living in poverty in various scenarios. So you had grandparents raising young children and teenagers. You had single parents. You had young parents. It was all over the board. It was also a very racially diverse group of scenarios. And they were basically running between these fold-out chairs in the middle of the gym that were serving as sort of their pretend homes between various social services and also places like the grocery store, places where they were supposed to go pay their rent or their mortgage. And also the payday loan center. There was also a makeshift jail there as well. If you were caught stealing or if you were a child in the scenario and you were caught skipping school, you might find yourself in juvenile detention.
Lee, I was reading the online version of your story, and there was one line that really stood out to me, and I'm going to read it really quickly. It says, "A middle-aged white man walked around the gymnasium with a black baby doll strapped to his chest. He was playing the role of a single black mother in her teens."
Yeah, I should also note that part of the issue with that is that this is a school district that is 90% white, and also the median income there is close to $100,000. So it was kind of questionable whether or not the scenarios that were actually being played out had a lot of bearing on that particular community and the way poverty looked there.
Yeah, a lot of pitfalls there. Brenda Lindsay, you're an assistant dean for undergrad programs at the U of I School of Social Work, as we mentioned. You've led poverty simulations before. Does what you're hearing from Lee match up with what you've done?
Well, the details on this on the simulation do, but our experience has actually been a lot more positive. The School of Social Work on campus hosts an annual poverty simulation as part of the Martin Luther King celebration. Of all the things that Dr. King talked about, one of the things that mattered most was the issue of poverty. And so we host the poverty simulation in honor of him. And the simulation itself is part of the simulation, but actually the most important part is the discussion that happens afterwards, the debriefing. And that's usually the first hour is the simulation, and then the second hour is actually the debriefing part. And I think that's the most important part.
You're saying the context that you put the simulation in is the most important part.
I don't know if I would say that. I think what I'm saying is that I think the debriefing where people talk about their experiences, and we start with the volunteers. So the volunteers that are staffing the community resources and the local businesses that she talked about, we have them talk about what they observed first and then followed by the participants themselves. And it's usually pretty eye-opening because many times what happens is that the volunteer vendors that are there usually have a lot more services that they could have offered, but nobody asked them for them. And likewise, what we notice about the participants is that at the beginning, they generally will try to solve the issue of how to live day-to-day in poverty within the simulation by doing what usually works in their life. And most of them are middle class, at least, if not upper middle class. And so the things that they're used to having and taking for granted as the weeks go on in the simulation, they become a little bit more sensitized to what it could be like for somebody that didn't have some of the benefits that they do in their own life.
Is there an example that particularly stuck out to you that people may not have realized something and they have this epiphany?
Yeah, I think, for example, one of our vendors is a pawnbroker, and there's probably a lot of people in our simulation that either have never been to a pawnbroker or have never had to pawn anything. And I think even understanding how that works, understanding how the quick cash and the payday loans work, and I think many of them are surprised. Most of our families by the end of the month in our simulation, most of people are not able to feed their families and keep shelter over their heads, which is the main thing that we ask them to do. And so I think that is eye-opening to them in and of itself.
Hmm. Lee, who came up with these programs? Where did they originally come from?
Well, most of the poverty simulations that are in use in the United States come from the Missouri Community Action Network, which is based in St. Louis. And they purchased the rights to the simulation from a welfare reform group that was working in St. Louis. And so that welfare reform group created this simulation, and they based it on scenarios of people living in St. Louis. And then what I was told from MCAN was that basically they adapted the simulation to be more reflective of people living in poverty across the state of Missouri.
Mm. And I was struck by your reporting about how many of these they've sold. Can you detail the numbers?
Yeah, they've sold about, I think they've sold more than 1,400 of these kits. And each kit contains about 22,000 pieces. So they're really designed for large groups of people to use. And they've sold most of these kits to universities and schools, but they've actually also sold a few of them. I found this particularly interesting. They sold a few of them to utility companies to try and sensitize the people that are sort of on the other line at these companies to the reality that some of their customers may be facing.
And when you say 22,000 pieces to a kit, I can't even imagine what would take up that many, that much material. What are these pieces? What are we talking about?
Well, I think a lot of it is just like signs, like little, like the baby dolls, name tags, certain props that go along with each of, like, the payday loan, the pawn broker, things like that. So because it's such a large number of people that are participating, you end up having a lot of pieces.
And there are a lot of schools using these too?
Yes, that's the majority of, I was told that the majority of their customers are schools and universities.
And in the case of Muhammad, who are the participants role-playing as? And did that match up with, you mentioned that the community is economically a little different. Can you describe what that mismatch was and where it might have matched up?
Well, it was just kind of strange because I thought it was great that they had such a diverse range of scenarios, and I think that that probably is reflective of Missouri as a state. But in terms of being reflective of Muhammad as a community, like I said, it's vastly majority white. It has a very high median income, although I was also told that the percentage of children in that community on free or reduced lunch, which is how they measure poverty, has also increased over the years. It still didn't really seem to match up with some of these family scenarios. I mean, you had a lot of basically just a lot of white people role playing people of color living in poverty.
And Brenda, you were touching about this on this earlier. How do you account for that? How do you make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, actually, the scenarios in the poverty simulation are pre-selected by the Missouri Action Community Program that she talked about. And I guess from my perspective, it's more important for people to understand the day-to-day realities. And I, you know, since I wasn't at that simulation, I don't know how what the participants took away from it. But to me, I think the lesson is, of course, it is important to try to put yourself in someone else's shoes. Mm-hmm. And it is a simulation. It is a role play. But at the end of the day, what you want people to really think about is that, you know, this could happen maybe to almost anybody. Anybody can lose their job. Anybody could have a partner or a spouse or a family member die or leave them, and then you're left to figure out, how am I going to manage this? How am I going to be able to afford to, you know, to feed my kids? How am I going to be able to afford to, you know, to keep a roof over their heads? And so I, you know, like I said, the way that we approach it in our simulation is that we want people to think about whatever their career path is, because we get people, some are nursing students, some are law students, some want to be teachers, some are people from the community, some are legislators, some are ministers, some are people that are just read about it in the paper and want to participate. And so what we ask them to do is to think about, in our community, what can you do personally to raise awareness and to be able to address some of the day-to-day problems of people living in poverty? So some people decide, you know, they were going to educate their family and friends. We have other people that decide they're going to support either through donated money or donated volunteering time at local food pantries or at a homeless shelter. Some are going to get more politically active and advocate for fairer policies. So really, at the end of the day, we want them to think, to come away and think a little bit differently about what they knew, what they learned as a result of their experience versus what they thought when they first came in.
What do you think are some of the key points that people learn or get a more personal understanding of when it comes to people living in poverty that they might not know going in?
Well, personally, I think one of the most eye-opening things is how many children live in poverty. So almost a quarter of the children in our country live in poverty. In our community in Champaign County, at least half of the students countywide are on free and reduced lunch, and which is a benchmark for low income. The statewide average is almost 50%, and I think people are really surprised about that. Most of the kids that are are living in poverty, you know, have parents who are working. Maybe they have a job that is unstable or isn't a full-time job or doesn't have benefits. I think the other thing that people are surprised at is that food stamps, which are officially called SNAP benefits or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, people are surprised to learn that most people that get those benefits run out of food about the third week of the month. And so for the last week, a lot of them, in order to get by, are turning to our local food pantries, which has put a lot of stress on our local community resources. And so, again, thinking about what can we do here in our community to be able to support the people that live here.
Hmm. And Lee, what was your sense, both from your own experience at the simulation and talking to the people who were doing it? How effective was it at building empathy? Did it depend on who's doing the simulation and what facilitators did after it? How would you characterize it?
I think it depended a lot on context. I actually, for this story, I interviewed a social work professor from California State University at Chico. Her name is Susan Roll. And inspired by her own discomfort, the first time that she did this simulation, she really felt the sense that the kids, I shouldn't call them kids, they were undergraduate students who were doing the simulation were really just role-playing. And it felt like people living in poverty were very much otherized. She decided to do this study. So what she did was she surveyed the students' attitudes toward poverty immediately after they completed the simulation and then several more times over the course of several months. And what her research found was that these attitudes, these changes in attitude did not hold over time. And so even if the students came away immediately feeling more empathy towards people living in poverty, that empathy began to fade. So I actually asked her, what did you do to kind of counteract that issue? And she said, really trying to make it clear to the students who were participating in the simulation that this is not something that happens to an other. This is something that's happening in their immediate community. And, there's 30% of the people that are even in this classroom right now may have experienced poverty at some point in their lives or are currently experiencing it. But I will say, I asked her, are you still using this simulation? And she said no, because it is a very heavy lift. And she felt like it was so hard, or it was took so much effort to contextualize it in a way that was not going to, be a waste of her time or a waste of the students' times or potentially reinforce false stereotypes, that she decided a better way to get the students engaged with poverty was to actually just bring them out into the community, have them meet with social service providers, and actually have them meet with people who are experiencing poverty.
Hmm. And Brenda, what about it? How do you maintain that empathy that you work so hard to develop in the folks who are taking these simulations, who are learning from you? Does it inevitably fade over time?
Well, first of all, I do want to say she is right that a one-and-done experience isn't going to change somebody's life. Mm-hmm. But I think what we are hoping to do is at least get our foot in the door, raise the question, raise the issue about what can you do. So, for example, even here on campus, about 25% of the students on campus are food insecure. And they are students that have told us in a survey that one of my colleagues did, Sherry Faulkner at the School of Social Work, one of the things that they reported is that they don't feel like that they're deserving to go to food pantries. And again, mm-hmm. You wouldn't think on our campus that should be that it should be like that, because...
And we should clarify that food insecure means they're just not sure when and if their meal is
going
to come.
Right, because they don't have enough money to get through the month. So I do want to say that I feel like we want to get our foot in the door. I mean, in terms of our particular efforts at the School of Social Work, this is not the only thing that we do to try to raise awareness about social issues in our community. This is one thing that we do. And so I do think that it does require a long-term sustained effort. I think that there have been other studies that do support and other professions that have had very successful efforts in being able to raise awareness among dental students, medical students, nursing students, lawyers, again, legislators, policymakers. But I agree, it needs to be part of an intentional overall effort.
An intentional overall effort. Lee Gaines, education reporter with the Illinois Newsroom, and Brenda Lindsay, assistant dean for undergraduate programs at the University of Illinois School of Social Work. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual Book, Jacket, and Journal Show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, April 2nd through the 13th. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nova Safo in for Nyla Boodoo. Engineers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign want to transform the way farmers collect data out in their fields. The idea is that more data equals better crop yields. So how do you improve data gathering? Why, with robots, of course. That's where Professor Girish Chowdhury and his team come in. They're working on a robot. It's called Terra Sentia. It's lightweight, nimble, and collects data automatically, a process that can otherwise be expensive and time-consuming for farmers. Professor Chowdhury is in our studios right now in Urbana to tell us more about his robot and how he could change the future of farming. Professor Chowdhury, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
All right, tell us a little bit about your robot. What does it look like and what does it do?
Yeah, sure. So the Terra Sentia is a small robot, so by small, I mean that it's small enough to fit within a standard corn row, which is about 30 inches or so. The robot's actually only about 14 inches wide and about 20 or so inches long.
And it's so, like a little box on wheels, right, with a little head?
Right, yeah, top. Yeah, almost, right? So right now that's how it looks like. Basically, we're trying to just maximize all the space that's inside the robot, so it looks like it's okay. A box on wheels. Like you said, it has four wheels. It looks like a box, has some sensors that are pointing out of the box, and has these cool lights that are surrounding the cameras on the robots, which basically light up the plants as it gets close to them.
And so what does the robot do exactly?
The current robot goes through the crop trying to measure specific phenotypes or specific traits of the crop. So, for example, in the beginning of the season, what it can do is it can go through the crop and measure how many seeds have germinated. So what's known as a stand count, how many plants are there. Then as the plants start to grow taller, the robot then shifts its attention to measuring how tall are the plants. And then as the plants are, you know, of significant girth and size, it starts to measure the width of the stems for these plants.
So a lot of this data, it's going around with basically a camera and it's measuring these things. It can recognize all these various features of a plant just with its video eyes?
Right. So that's the goal. So we're teaching it to do that, right? So it can do that. It's not as good as a human yet, but it's getting there pretty quick. In fact, in some ways, it's really lagging behind a human. It has a lot of trouble following differentiating between corn and, they look almost the same. But in other ways, it's actually going beyond a human because what it can do is it can use the video to estimate the width of the corn, which is something that, I don't know how to do that, but the robot can do it because it has the algorithms inbuilt.
So is this similar to technology that is being used to teach cars autonomous driving in terms of recognizing objects, images, things like that?
Absolutely, yeah. It's very much similar to that technology, but there are some very unique and important differences. So this, like getting a robot to drive autonomously in a field is quite a bit harder than getting a car to drive autonomously. And that by itself is rather hard, as we have already seen. In the last couple of weeks. So when you're on the streets, the good news is you can use maps, you can use known objects that don't change their location, right? So this building is going to be there no matter how often I pass by the street, at least for the foreseeable future. In a farm, unfortunately, that's not the case. The way a farm looks changes literally on a daily basis. So how does a robot deal with that? So with autonomous driving, what people have been doing is they've been relying a lot on these maps and this information that's already there. For us, we have to kind of deal with a new day every day. And on top of that, of course, a robot-soil interaction is quite a bit harder in the farm than on roads where it's more predictable because the soil can change its texture and the friction between the soil and the wheel can change quite significantly due to rain or excessive heat or debris that's lying mm-hmm. on the floor.
So why go through all this trouble if this is so complicated? What is this technology for in terms of helping farmers in the future?
So it's really hard to go out on a hot, sweltering day in the middle of a cornfield and measure some plants.
I mean, think a lot of people will attest to that.
So that's one aspect of it. So the other aspect of it is not really a job that requires a very large level of skill, right? Mm-hmm. And the humans that are involved actually would prefer that this data be handed out to them so that they can actually use the data to make decisions about what they should do in breeding or in managing their crop rather than actually having to go through the fields and collect this data.
So you're talking about like the way we wear like a health tracker to track all of our data so we can figure out how we're doing. This is what farmers will be doing, real-time data constantly being gathered to determine how the crops are doing?
So over time, these robots will be running around in the field complementing drones that are flying in the sky. So the drones can't see under the canopy. And what they'll do is they'll send this data back. So like I was saying, it's so hard to get this data. What we do is we just don't get it. And we kind of just hope, the famous saying, spray and pray, right? We just mm-hmm. spray our fields and we pray that nothing bad happens because we don't really have a lot of modalities of controlling what happens, especially when the canopy starts to grow. So the hope is that these robots will make this possible. And they'll make it possible in such an easy way because they'll be autonomous, they'll be in there all the time, that we will completely transform the way we do agriculture.
At what point does this turn into a Terminator movie with drones up in the sky and the robots running around on the ground?
The robots don't have any weapons.
But they have artificial intelligence. And if we remember Stephen Hawking, the late, great Stephen Hawking's words, he actually cautioned, in all seriousness, that artificial intelligence has to be managed, right?
So, absolutely.
Are you keeping this in mind in terms of your research? Yeah. And how do we control these robots? How do we work with them in a constructive way?
Yeah. So I think, there's a general misperception like for humans to portray their intelligence mm-hmm. on a robot, right? So and there's good reason because that's how the media has been portraying this, right? So just because a robot or a computer can beat a human at the game of Go doesn't mm-hmm. mean that robot can cook breakfast for me, right? Those mm-hmm. are two totally different tasks. Now, a person who's really good at Go can probably cook decent breakfast, but for a robot, that generalization doesn't exist. So just because a robot can go through a farm and collect some data and analyze it using the algorithms it has doesn't mean it can do anything else. So these are just, we would want them to be intelligent, and they exhibit certain traits of intelligence, but it's mostly algorithmic and constrained to what they've been taught or programmed to do.
I see. And another concern, of course, is whether machines take over the jobs that humans do. We've seen concerns like this with automatic tellers in mm-hmm. retail stores. Is there a concern like that with your robot, or are they doing work to augment work that humans are doing?
Right. So we are very much on the augmentation side because mm-hmm. what we want the human to do is be at the edge of the field, send the robot in, and the robot will get the data in a safe and efficient manner and record the data so that the person can go back in a nice air-conditioned room and analyze that data and understand what's going on. It's very hard to make decisions when the sun's shining on your head.
Yeah, that's very true. How expensive will this technology be? How available will it be to daily farmers? Do you have a sense of that yet?
Yes. So So this year, we created a startup through the university. My colleague Chinmay Soman is the CEO of this startup company. The company is called EarthSense. And EarthSense offered these robots to early adopters at a cost of $5,000, which is in itself pretty groundbreaking, because robot technology like this has not been available at such a low cost. And it's by design. We've realized through a lot of the federal funding that we've had, as we've searched and talked with farmers, we've realized that cost is a big driving factor. So we've tried to make the technology accessible, and we're hoping that it'll continue to be even more accessible as we go into larger scale manufacturing.
So early adopters, there are farmers out there using this technology now. What is the feedback they've sent you?
So most of the people who are using it right now are breeders, because they're the ones who are really hungry for the data, and they're using this technology to create better seeds so that the farmers can use these better seeds to create higher yielding crops. So breeders are really excited right now about the ability to collect repeatedly high-quality data in an autonomous fashion. What that does for them is two things. One is it removes any kind of uncertainty in the way someone would measure things, right? For example, how I would measure height of a plant might be different than someone else, even though they've both received the same training. It's just a difference in perception. And the second is everything is recorded, and they can have it and go back at it and feed their other analysis pipeline. So they're really excited about those two things.
That's very fascinating. So when will farmers on a broader scale have access to this technology?
So we just started a National Science Foundation project, which is going to study further how these robots can be utilized for other aspects on farms, including weeding. So when that technology matures, we expect that we will be able to release these robots to people.
You know, it's always different when you go from research into the real world. With all these early adopters using your technology now, what have been some surprises, things that you didn't anticipate?
It's really hard to get these things to be autonomous in the harsh, uncertain environments. So the thing is that nature is extremely unpredictable. And, you know, when we design the robots, we program them for doing one thing, and then we go show up on the next day and it has rained in the night, or maybe an animal ran through and now the field is very different, right? So dealing with that change and, you know, creating the fundamental science to accommodate that change in the planning algorithms, in the control algorithms of the robot, has been one of the challenges. So that's you know, that's more on the side of what we're trying to do to improve the technology. But there's been a lot of positive surprises too. So one of the surprises is that we go to people and we show them the robot, and you know, they start telling us what things they want the robot to do. So we don't even have to tell them how we think they should use the robot. They already have a pretty good idea of what they would have an agricultural robot do. So that's been very surprising and heartening.
Well, like what? What have they been telling you?
So it was very interesting. So we went to India, and we went in these rural areas where, you know, people are far removed from cities and a high level of technology. And we were showing them the robots, and they're like, oh, can I talk to the robot using my cell phone? So because they all have smartphones, right? And will it go and find diseases for me? Because that's really a problem for me. You know, if I get a disease in my farm and I don't know it on time, then I lose my yield. And it's really important for the small scale farmers in the poorer countries, because they're dealing with 40 acres, 30 acres, or even less, and that's all they have, right? They need that 30, 40 acres to work for them to be able to feed their families. So they can, if a technology like this is made accessible to them at a very low cost, I think it will really change the way they do farming too.
And what have you heard from farmers here in Illinois?
So in Illinois, it has been, I think, you know, we have just extremely positive response. So all of our early adopter program pretty much is focused in the Midwest and some places on the East Coast. But farmers are extremely excited about this technology. They want little robotic equipment to go through the farms and do things. Because right now they only have two options, right? They can either go and buy the large John Deere tractors or Caterpillar equipment, which is great at doing high throughput tasks. Or they can hire manual labor, which is, you know, great at doing dexterous tasks but hard to find. They have really no options in the middle. So this robot really provides them a new option, and they're really excited about that.
And final question for you. What's TerraSentia mean? What's behind the name?
It's actually a take on the name of the company and also the project, the Department of Energy project that funded the early development of this robot. So that Department of Energy ARPA-E project was called TerraMEP. So, right. And our company was called EarthSense. So you take Terra, which is Earth, and Sense, which is Sentia, and you get TerraSentia.
All right, Professor Girish Chowdhury, who's working on this very interesting robot at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. I'm Nova Safo, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.